So this is the last lecture on QCD. And so yesterday we kind of got far enough into the structure of perturbative QCD. What I wanted to do today was to talk about a little about the non-perturbative low-energy structure of QCD. Now, I told you a couple days ago that there really wasn't much one could say about that, but it turns out that's not really correct. There's at least a lecture's worth of material. So let me discuss it. The main starting point for this lecture will be the masses of the up and down quarks. Now, we already know that the up and down quarks are the lightest two quarks. And we know that they're somehow significantly lighter than the strange quark. But now, I guess especially for things we're going to do next week, it'll be very important to figure out exactly how light the up and down quarks are. So what I'm going to do in this talk is to propose that the up and down quark masses are nearly zero. And I'd like to work out consequences of that. And it will turn out that the theory where the up and down quark masses are, well, let's just take the limit, where the up and down quark masses are zero, is actually quite an interesting theory with enhanced symmetry. The symmetry will lead to new predictions, and then we can confront those predictions with experiment. So let's get started. So what I'm going to do now is write down QCD with two massless flavors. And maybe I should just write that over here so we have this. So the theory which I'm mainly concerned with today is QCD plus Q bar I V slash Q, where Q is up and down. And in fact, I want to distinguish the left and right-handed species of up and down. And actually, this is kind of interesting. If there's no mass term, there's nothing in this Lagrangian that actually couples the up species to the down species. Yes? Oh, yes. There's nothing in this Lagrangian that actually couples the up species to the down species. And so this theory has an enhanced symmetry over what we were talking about before. Namely, if I want to make an isospin rotation on the left-handed species, I can do that completely independently of an isospin rotation on the right-handed species. So I claim that this theory, then, has the symmetry SU2 cross SU2 cross U1, where this guy here is baryon number. So that's very familiar. This guy here is isospin. So that's something that we're familiar with, at least from last week. And this is a completely new, unfamiliar symmetry called chiral isospin. So let me just write down these symmetries. So baryon number U1, basically I'm going to rotate Q left into Q left and Q right into Q right. Okay, and that symmetry corresponds to the overall fermion number conservation in the theory. SU2 of isospin, Q left goes to e to the I beta dot tau. In this lecture, by the way, tau will be sigma over 2. So that's the generator of SU2. Q left, Q right goes to e to the I beta dot tau, Q right. Then there's another choice that I have. I could independently rotate Q left and rotate Q right in the other direction. And I think I'd like to put the minus sign here. And there's one more thing that I could do, and be it, that'll go all the way over here, which is chiral baryon number, namely to rotate Q left by a phase and Q right by the opposite phase. And so somehow it seems that this Lagrangian, actually it's true at the classical level, has all four symmetries, U1 and an extra U1, and isospin and an extra SU2 symmetry. Now, our main tool for working with these symmetries will be the currents which are associated with these symmetries. So for every symmetry in a relativistic field theory, there's a current. The current satisfies d mu j mu equals 0. And the charge, the conserved charge that is conserved by virtue of the symmetry, is the integral d3x of j0. And as you all know, this statement implies the conservation of Q defined in this way. So let me then write down the currents for these various theories. So baryon number, what you have generally are the Qs, and then in here goes whatever charge will generate the symmetry. So for baryon number, I just have exactly this. And that's the usual Q bar gamma mu Q. For isospin, there are three isospin currents. I construct them in this way. Tau AQ. So for chiral isospin, it's the same deal. I'm going to call that J mu 5A. And I'm going to leave off the I. There's an extra minus sign that goes here. And remember that gamma 5, the Dirac matrix gamma 5, is plus on Q right and minus on Q left. So I could write this as gamma mu gamma 5 tau AQ. And then probably it wouldn't surprise you that the chiral baryon current is just Q bar gamma mu gamma 5. And at the classical level in QCD, with zero mass up and down quarks, all of these currents are conserved, and their charges are all conserved charges in the theory. These symmetries are all symmetries in the theory. Now, I'd just like to tell you, I'm not going to explain this very well, that chiral baryon number is actually not a symmetry of this theory. And the reason for that is actually a quite subtle point of quantum field theory. The chiral baryon current has a matrix element to two gluons. And you can draw, in particular, these triangle diagrams. And there's an extra epsilon mu nu lambda sigma because this is an odd parity. This is an odd parity thing. Now, it turns out that these triangle diagrams are very malicious. They have a divergence. The divergence needs to be regulated. And it turns out that this divergence cannot be regulated consistently with the conservation of all three currents in the loop. So if you preserve two currents, the other one has to be violated. And two of the currents here are the symmetry currents of QCD. So if we violate those symmetries, we lose QCD gauge invariance, which is something we really don't want to do. And so these diagrams then imply that d mu j mu 5 is not equal to 0. And what stands on the other side are some operators that have to do with the gluon field. So this phenomenon, which actually we're going to see again next week, is called the axial vector anomaly. It's an important topic in kind of the next level of quantum field theory that you haven't had yet. But that's all I'm going to say about it here. For the moment, I'd just like you to recognize that this guy, even though it looks like a symmetry of the theory, is actually wiped out by quantum effects. OK. Now, Baryon number and isospin are manifest symmetries of the hadron spectrum, as we saw in the first lecture of this course. However, this chiral isospin is not a symmetry of the hadron spectrum. And in fact, it's even worse than that. A quark mass term would be m cube r cube. So it would be something that would link together the left and right-handed states, massless states in the quark field. So this interaction is manifestly not invariant under a symmetry where I rotate the lefts and rights in different directions. So another way to say it is that if chiral isospin is a symmetry, this mass term is forbidden. And maybe I should say it's not only the quark mass, but also the baryon masses that are forbidden if chiral isospin is a symmetry. So this is very inconsistent with what we see in nature. Nevertheless, I'd like to hang on with this theory a little, because there's another way we could argue our way out of this problem. We know that quarks at long distances have strong interactions. So whenever I get a couple quarks together, they'll interact strongly, they'll tug on each other, and naively you might think that that interaction would probably give them some mass. So if that's true, that means that the strong interactions of QCD have the power to generate a mass even though it's symmetry forbidden. And so they would have the power to, as in the words that you probably did in your statistical mechanics class, cause the symmetry to become a spontaneously broken symmetry. So now I'd like to give a slightly more cogent argument for that. This argument has a strong analogy to the theory of superconductivity. It's due to Nambu, who was the great pioneer of this subject. Nambu actually introduced this in a paper with Jean Alesigno. And for those of you who don't know anything about the theory of superconductivity, you just have to take this argument literally. So let's think about the vacuum state of this theory that I wrote down, QCD with massless up and down quarks. So then there are various vacuum states that we could talk about. And the one that's actually realized in nature is the vacuum state of lowest energy. Now, that might be the perturbative vacuum, where we just have, the vacuum that we usually do perturbation theory around with massless quarks. However, in this theory, I notice that there are some interactions like this, and this, and this in the Hamiltonian that would cause pair creation and pair annihilation of pairs of quarks. And in the perturbative vacuum, all of these Hamiltonian matrix elements have zero expectation value. So they don't contribute to the vacuum energy. But on the other hand, if I have in the vacuum of nature a condensate of some quark-antiquark pairs, I can then get expectation values for these operators. And I can take advantage of this, and I can even find a way to lower the vacuum energy. Now, for massive quarks, it costs energy to make a pair of a quark and antiquark and put that on top of the vacuum. But for massless quarks, it costs hardly anything. So let's try it. So in particular, I advocate the following pairs: a quark and an antiquark with total momentum zero and total angular momentum zero. Well, total angular momentum zero is slightly subtle. If this guy here is left-handed, then this guy also must be left-handed. And similarly, if one of these guys is right-handed, the other one must be right-handed. And if we have ups and downs, we could also make this an up-up bar pair and this a down-down bar pair. And then we would also have an isospin symmetric situation. So if I fill the vacuum with these pairs and the analogous pairs interchanging left and right, then I can fill the vacuum with quark-antiquark pairs. It costs relatively little energy to do that. I get back some energy from these terms here, which I can now give expectation values to. This is a kind of kinematic energy. The energy here is proportional to g squared. So you might say at sufficiently strong coupling, these diagrams will win. The vacuum of QCD will fill with a condensate of quark-antiquark pairs. And in that condensate, now I have to argue that in that condensate, chiral isospin symmetry will be broken. Well, let's look at the chiral isospin quantum numbers of these particles. So this is a U left. This is a U right. A U right is the antiparticle of, U left bar is the antiparticle of U right. And so what's going on now is that if these guys would have opposite isospin, but then because of that minus sign, they have a parallel quantum number under chiral isospin. So this is a state of net chiral isospin. And similarly, this is a state of net chiral isospin. So the vacuum doesn't respect chiral isospin. It respects all the other symmetries. And this is just the situation of spontaneous symmetry breaking, the same situation that you have in a magnet or a superfluid. So if you hang on to those analogies from statistical mechanics, did you guys study the theory of superconductivity, by the way, or superfluidity? Did Kadanoff must have mentioned the word spontaneous symmetry breaking. You studied magnets. Okay. So hang on to your intuition from magnets. More is coming. Okay. So did Kadanoff mention the word order parameter? Okay. So the next question is, what's the order parameter? So here's a choice for it that I think makes a lot of sense. So the order parameter I claim is the operator just q bar q. That is, or maybe I should say q bar left, q right is a good thing to take for the order parameter. So what I'm going to now is characterize this state by the statement that u bar u and d bar d get vacuum expectation values in this state. I think in my notes I called it omega, just to emphasize that it's a non-trivial vacuum. And I'm going to call that number minus delta. It has the dimensions of mass cubed. And we'll estimate it, this is justified by lattice gauge theory calculations, at roughly 300 MeV cubed. OK. And when this is not equal to 0, that's the statement that this is an order parameter, and the symmetry, these operators violate chiral isospin symmetry. The symmetry is spontaneously broken. Yes?
Did you just say what an order parameter is?
Oh, an order parameter is it's a thermodynamic expectation value, which, if it is non-zero in a thermodynamic state, signals that a symmetry is spontaneously broken. So the expectation value is forbidden by symmetry, but nevertheless, it's there. So it's like the magnetization of a magnet. If it's there, the symmetry is spontaneously broken. Okay. Now, actually, let me rewrite this equation as omega q bar left q right is equal to minus 1/2 delta ij. Oh. Delta, where these are now isospin indices. I and j equals u and d. I think I wanted a 2 here, and then it's not there. Please excuse me. Okay, that factor of 2 is going to plague us in this course. I think it's wrong in my notes. I'll fix it later. In any event, I would like to use this statement to now prove something else that's interesting about the breaking of chiral isospin. Namely, that chiral isospin actually indicates that this is, if this is now a characterization of the vacuum of QCD, this is not the only vacuum of this theory with two massless quarks. Actually, there is an infinite manifold of degenerate vacuum states. This is the analog in a magnet to the various thermodynamic states you get by globally rotating the magnetization. So if it can be magnetized in this direction, it can be magnetized in that direction. And so then there are actually a whole manifold of broken symmetry states. Here we would obtain those states by performing a chiral isospin rotation on the fields. So if I let Q, and maybe I should write this as Ji, if I let Q right go to U, Ji, J, J bar, Q right, J bar, and then I let Q left, now Q left rotates in the opposite direction, so that's U inverse J, J bar on Q left. Okay, now what about Q bar? Well, Q bar is now going to get rotated by the adjoint of this, but the adjoint is the inverse. So Q bar is going to get rotated by U again. And so this object here, under this transformation, gets rotated to the following thing, the expectation value of QQ bar times U on one side and U on the other side. And so now we've constructed a vacuum where the expectation value of Q left, Q bar right is U squared Ji times delta. So the modulus is the same, but the delta ij has been turned actually into an arbitrary SU2 matrix. And so that makes sense. If I start doing chiral isospin rotations on these guys, this guy goes one way, this guy goes the other way, this changes. And so if I do an arbitrary rotation, I can actually get any SU2 matrix here. Now, as you guys know, SU2 is a group whose group manifold looks like the unit sphere in four dimensions, the three sphere, S3. So you could think of this state as the state that lives at the top, and then these states as a transition to an arbitrary point on this manifold. And for every point in SU2, or every point on the sphere S3, there's another degenerate state with the U and D quarks, the left-handed UD and the right-handed UD, just aligned with their phases somewhat different. And all of those states are degenerate in the limit where these are all good symmetries. Okay, so this is, as I say, exactly the same thing that you saw in the case of the magnet. And just as in the case of a magnet, the same next interesting thing happens. So these states are created by applying the charge of the isospin symmetry to the vacuum. Namely, we apply the integral d3x of alpha times j0, which is q bar gamma mu gamma 5q. And if we apply that to this state, then we get one of these rotated states. So the next thing we could try is applying not a uniform application of, this should be J0, not a uniform application of the charge, but let's apply a charge which is different depending on where we are in space, something like this, e to the I integral d4 d3x times alpha times e to the I kx. Q bar gamma 0, there should be a tau here. Gamma 5 tau Q. Okay. Now, what is this state? Well, in this state, I'm going to do the isospin rotation, which takes me from here, this vacuum, to this vacuum, but in a wavy way. I'm not going to do it here. I'm going to do it a little here. I'm going to do it a little more there. And what I end up with is a wave of isospin rotation along space. And what is the state? Well, it's not the vacuum. In particular, it contains modes that have the momentum k. But if I send k to 0, it turns into the vacuum. And so it's something that has a very low energy and an energy that becomes 0 in the limit where k goes to 0. So in particular, let's consider the single particle states associated with this. So I can now take the vacuum. I can act on it with Q0 tau A Q, and I can Fourier transform this. And that is a mode, probably at least contains a one particle state. The state has momentum K, and this is odd parity. It has odd parity, it has isospin 1, and the energy of this state must go to 0 as k goes to 0. So I would like to call this state pi a of k. And as I say, if there's a one particle state in here, which there should be, it has those properties. Momentum k, isospin a, odd parity, and an energy that goes to 0 when k goes to 0. And in a Lorentz invariant theory, that means that the mass of this state must be 0. And I shouldn't have said state. There are 3 of them, one for each value of A, and they form an isospin triplet. So odd parity, isospin triplet. OK, well, we have seen such a thing before. It's the pion, the pions. And the pions, of course, we know are the lightest hadrons. And they're really light. I mean, the vector mesons are at 700-800 GeV. The proton is at close to 700-800 MeV. The proton is close to 1 GeV. The pions are down at 130 MeV. So it's very attractive to say QCD, if we send the up and down quark masses to 0, would be a theory with this extra chiral isospin symmetry. The strong interactions spontaneously break the chiral isospin symmetry. We end up with this manifold of vacuum states. We then tweak those states just a little. The natural excitations are some massless states which have exactly the quantum numbers of the pion. And then we'll turn on a little up and down quark mass, and probably we'll give these things mass. I'll calculate that in a moment. And then the up and down quark masses are not just a little lighter than the strange quark. They're spectacularly light. The masses are almost 0. And this guy, the pions, are almost in that limit as we approach that limit, massless particles. Once again, something Leo probably told you is that every time you spontaneously break a continuous symmetry, you get a massless particle. The argument is exactly the one I've given you here. That particle is called a Goldstein boson. So in the case of this example, there are 3 continuous symmetries, namely the 3 components of chiral isospin that are spontaneously broken. And so we get 3 massless particles. And then if I break the symmetry by some explicit terms, by giving the up and down quark a mass, then I can give small masses to these Goldstein bosons. We're going to see more Goldstein bosons next week. So please remind yourself that this is a very general argument. Okay. Well, I guess the next thing to do... Oh, no, there's one more thing that we need to do. We need to write one more equation, which is that a nice way of characterizing these Goldstein bosons is that they're the things that are created or destroyed by the current, the symmetry current. So let me write J mu 5a of x. Let's just try and write the matrix element between the current and the of the current between the pion and the vacuum. So I've convinced you, hopefully, that these particles exist, that this matrix element exists. By general considerations of Lorentz invariance, there's only one form that this can take. There's an e to the ikx, e to the minus ik dot x. This index has to go somewhere. The only momentum around is k. So let me write k mu. This guy actually has dimensions of mass squared. So a dimensionful parameter must be supplied. And then isospin is still a good symmetry. So I have to write delta v. This quantity here is, I wrote it as f pi. It's called f pi. In the strong interactions, its value is 92 MeV. And I'll show you the experimental determination of that on Monday. OK. Well, what's the obvious thing you would do to this equation? This is a conserved current. Let's use the fact that d mu j mu 5 is equal to 0. The Fourier transform of that equation is that k mu of this matrix element is 0. If I dot k mu into this, it's k squared times f pi. That's 0, so k squared must be 0. So now I've given you a much cleaner proof that this particle is a massless particle. Okay. Now, actually, we can use this argument here to calculate the small mass that these particles acquire if I turn on a small up and down quark mass. And so let's just kind of get a little more precise about what we're doing. Here I've been working with three components of isospin 1, 2, 3. In pions, we're used to working with the pi plus, the pi 0, and the pi minus. So this will be given by pi plus is equal to pi 1 plus I pi 2. Pi 0 is the same thing as pi 3. And pi minus is 1 over the square root of 2 pi 1 minus I pi 2. And OK, so now let's compute the effect of taking this Lagrangian over here and adding small masses for u and d. If I do that, then the chiral currents are no longer conserved. But instead, they acquire some terms on the right-hand side. And you can, yes?
Where the pi 1, pi 2, and pi 3 are in relation to the right
side? Oh, A and B are, okay. Take the values 1, 2, and 3. So those are the three. So isospin is an SU2.
Yeah.
So there are 1, 2, and 3 axes. So A and B take the values 1, 2, and 3. And so if I, in the same way as you go from J, 1, 2, 3 to J plus, J3, J minus, that's the same thing. OK. Now, something that you ought to know about the Dirac equation is the following equation that I'm now going to use quite strongly. If I have one Dirac spinner and I take the divergence of the axial current, the answer on this side is 2i m, the particle mass, times psi bar gamma 5 psi. So that you can prove by manipulating the Dirac equation. And I'm going to now use that formula. So now let's compute, for example, d mu j mu 5 3. Well, j mu 5 3 has u bar gamma mu gamma 5 plus a half u minus plus d bar gamma mu gamma 5 minus a half u. So what sits here is just sigma 3 over 2. And so if I apply that equation, what I get here is I times mu times u bar gamma 5 u minus d bar gamma 5 d. Similarly, if I take the divergence of the current that destroys the pi minus or creates the pi plus, then this is, there's a square root of 2 that comes in here when you make this transformation, the square root of 2 u bar gamma mu gamma 5d. And if you do the same manipulation, what you will find is on this side, oh, sorry. Please excuse me. There should be an mu there, and there should be an md here. And this is still a half and a half. No, it's gone. And here, what will occur is an mu plus md times u bar gamma 5d. So what happens is that you get some now pseudoscalar terms on the right-hand side of the equation multiplied by mu and md. Okay, so now what I'd like to do is to use those equations together with the logic that I was using down here. So now I'd like to take this equation, for example, j mu 5 3 pi 0 is equal to I k mu f pi. Let's now take the divergence of that equation. So on this side, what we're going to get is what I've written here, mu u bar u plus md u bar gamma 5 u plus md d bar gamma 5 d. And on this side of the equation, I'm going to get, and there's some I that's going to cancel, and on this side of the equation, I get k squared f pi. And this is the mass of the pion times f pi. And over here, I get the matrix element of u bar gamma 5 u and d bar gamma 5 d in the pion state. And sorry, there's a minus sign here. And now I think I couldn't find a really fast way to prove this, but I hope you're not too upset if I write this equation. U bar gamma 5 u in the pion state is equal to u bar u times 1 over f pi. It's dimensionally correct. It's actually a correct formula. So this formula here will turn out to be mu plus md divided by f pi times this quantity delta, which is the order plane. Now we can solve for the pion mass. And the following formula appears. M pi squared is equal to delta over f pi squared times mu plus md. And actually, this formula turns out to be correct not only for the pi 0, but also from this equation. Here you see an mu plus md for the pi plus and pi minus. Okay, let's actually evaluate this formula. I told you it's 92 MeV in the denominator. For the numerator, I'm not so clear on this, but the number roughly from either the scale, the strong interactions, or lattice gauge theory estimates would be about 300 MeV. The pion mass is 138 MeV, but it comes, this number is much larger, and this comes squared. And so if I divide everything through, I find m up plus m down is equal to 6 MeV. So not only light, damn light. Okay. Now, there are some generalizations of this exercise. If I wanted, I could also consider the consequences of taking the strange quark light. The strange quark is heavier. Maybe it's too heavy to really consider it light, but you can at least play the game. So if we took the strange quark light, SU2 here would be extended to SU3. I would have, instead of 3 isospin currents, I would have 8 currents, which would be the adjoint representation of SU3. There would be 8 pseudoscalar meson fields, which would be relatively light compared to the other hadrons. Obviously, I should identify those with pi plus, pi zero, pi minus, the 4 kaons, and the eta. And if you do the same exercise, you get the following mass formula. That m pi squared is, you get the same formula. Oh. For mk plus, for example, you get the formula which has to do with its quark content. Mu plus ms times delta over f pi squared. Mk0 squared delta over f pi squared md plus ms. And for the eta, you get the following formula. You just have to write down the current, which is the... You guys remember you had so much trouble getting the lambda in the octet. So the current for the eta 0, there's some similar trouble. And when you resolve it, you get the following formula. 4ms plus mu plus md divided by 3 times delta over f pi squared. So these are predictions of the hypothesis that I can take the strange quark to be light also. I can put in all the quark masses as perturbations, and those lift up these Goldstone bosons, of which there are now 8, to some finite mass proportional to the perturbation. Now, these formulae are really interesting because, well, they give us a way of determining what all the quark mass ratios are just from the ratios of the squares of pseudoscalar meson hadron masses. And in fact, from these, and maybe I should say that K plus and the pi plus get contributions from electromagnetic interactions, which are outside the strong interactions entirely. But the pi plus, pi zero mass difference is so small, we know those effects aren't very significant. And people try to take them out, but it's not a big deal. So from these equations, we can actually get, from these equations, we can eliminate things and get the ratios of the up, down, and strange quark masses. And when you do that, you find that m down over m up is about 2, and m strange over m down is about 20. So if you believe this estimate, which I should say is much more approximate than these estimates here, then you would say the up quark is about at 2 MeV, the down quark is at 4 MeV, and the strange quark is about 80 MeV. And remember, the splittings in multiplets that we found in the baryon spectrum were 120 or so MeV. So within the accuracy of this number, that's probably a reasonable way of thinking about it. Okay, there's one more consequence of this equation, which is something called the Gell-Mann-Akubo formula. which is that 2 times mk plus squared plus mk0 squared is equal to 3 times m eta squared plus m pi squared. Just adding up the terms that I've written here. If I try and estimate the eta mass from this equation, the number I would get is 567 MeV. The correct number is 548. The approximation scheme was taking the strange quark to be approximately massless. So frankly, we're not doing too bad. OK. Now, I have a little time. I would like to discuss 2 additional applications of this formalism. There are lots more. Many of you know this subject under the name of current algebra, but I prefer to consider it this theory of spontaneously broken chiral symmetry. There are 2 more interesting applications, and let's see if I can get through them before the end of the hour. So the first one concerns, and the next one I'm going to do just for simplicity, in the absolute limit where the up and down quark masses are neglected and the pions are massless. So next time we're going to discuss the weak interactions. And something that's important in the weak interactions is the nucleon matrix element of the chiral isospin current. So this is something that we might want to know. You folks, I think, went through what a magnetic moment is. And so part of that argument is the general decomposition of this object in terms of form factors. And so let me write that down. So this is U of P prime. So there's a Lorentz structure like this. There's a Lorentz structure like this. So this thing is the magnetic moment form factor of the electron. And because this is a somewhat trickier current, there's a third structure that comes in, Q mu gamma 5. And this is called F3. And then U bar. So this object, again, has P coming in here, P prime going out there, Q going in this way, and it couples to the current. And so what I've just done is write a general Lorentz decomposition of this object. OK, now, in electrodynamics, this factor is 0. But to get that, we use current conservation. Oh, and maybe I should say one more thing. F1 of 0 is a quantity called G sub A, which it plays an important role in the theory of beta decay. And so it's interesting to know what this number is. That it's not 1. It's different from 1. And I'm going to now try and compute it. OK, let's take the divergence of this current. So let me dot Q mu with this current. And this, in the limit where the up and down quark masses are 0, is a conserved current. So this must be 0. So this is equal to, from this term here, U bar of P prime Q slash gamma 5 F of Q squared. This term just vanishes. And for this term, I get Q squared gamma 5 F3 of Q squared. Now, this term I can manipulate in the following way. I have u bar q slash gamma 5u. I write q slash as p prime minus p. P anti-commutes with gamma 5, so I can take that over to the other side. I get a plus sign. Now I use the fact that the u's are solutions to the Dirac equation. And I get 2m of the nucleon u bar gamma 5u. So this is equal to u bar gamma 5u times twice the mass of the nucleon times f of q squared, f1 of q squared. So my g sub a is in there. And then I get another term, q squared u bar gamma 5u f3. Okay. And this is supposed to be zero. And this now looks like it's a disaster. Because if I take q squared to zero, then this term should vanish. And this term, I told you, is non-zero at q squared equals zero. And so we're in serious trouble. However, in the theory that I'm talking about, where this current is conserved, the pion is massless. And so there's actually secretly a term that comes in and resolves this, which is the following. I can write down a term where the current here creates a pion that comes in and interacts with the nucleon. And I can get a current matrix element with that structure. And let's now write down the value of this diagram. It's here. G pi n n, that's the value of this vertex here. I think with the usual convention, there's a 2 here. The structure here is u bar gamma 5 tau a u. Then there's a pole, which gives me a 1 over q squared. And then there is an f pi q mu from this vertex. So that's when I create the pion. And what happens is that that term supplies an F3, where F3 is proportional to 1 over q squared. And so now we're in business. Now you can evaluate this factor here. And it turns out to be u bar gamma 5 u tau a, which should have been in there, q mu over q squared times f pi. Or in other words, F3 is equal to F pi over q squared. So now I can take the limit as q squared goes to 0 of this equation. And so I get all the same structures factoring out. Here I get 2mn times g sub a. And here I get from F, oh, please excuse me, one more important thing, g pi nn, the pion nucleon coupling constant. I get f pi times g pi nn. There's a minus sign here from the i's in this expression. And that's what we get. And now this is equal to 0. So now I get the following very interesting equation. G sub a is equal to f pi divided by the mass of the nucleon times g pi n. And this equation is called the Goldberger-Treeman equation. Don't ask me how Goldberger and Treeman derived it. It was a very crazy analysis. But anyway, you can plug in the numbers. So 92 MeV, the nucleon mass. The g pi nn, the latest determination of it is 13.3, a dimensionless number. Plug it all in. This side is equal to 1.31, I think. And the measured value of g sub a is 1.25. So once again, for something where we ignore the up and down quark masses, we ignore electromagnetism, a reasonable agreement of those numbers, which could, in principle, have been anything. The hour is getting late, but I wanted to tell you, just mention, one more application of chiral isospin symmetry, which will be written up a little further in the notes. Another property of this world where we have zero up and down quark mass is that you can not only say something about the pion mass, but you can actually predict the pion interactions. And the way I'd like to do this is, you remember that I characterized these manifold of vacuum states as saying that there was one for every SU2 matrix U. So what I'd like to do is to take U now to be a field on space. And let's try and write a Lagrangian in terms of U. So roughly, the pion field would appear in this way, as e to the I pi dot tau U, and actually, f pi should appear here. Correctly normalized. I'll put that in the notes. There's a factor of two. What does an effective Lagrangian for U look like? Well, this effective Lagrangian should be SU2 cross SU2 symmetric, and it should reflect the spontaneously broken symmetry. So I'd like to have SU2 symmetries act on this in the following way. Ordinary chiral symmetry will act in this way, and chiral isospin symmetry rotates U. That'll act in this way. And both of those symmetries should be symmetries of this theory. It turns out there's a unique Lagrangian with two derivatives that you can write. Actually, you can't write a Lagrangian with no derivatives because U dagger U is equal to 1. So there's no term with no derivatives. There's a unique term with two derivatives that has the symmetry. By the time you get up to four derivatives, you're at four derivatives. And so you're at high energy. And so the low energy structure of the theory is completely determined by this equation. I put f pi here. In the notes, I'll show you how you know that that coefficient is f pi. OK, well, this is now a theory of nonlinear pion interactions with no free parameters. So the question is, does it agree with experiment or not? So the answer is that it predicts pion interactions in three waves, in isospin 0, 1, and 2, S wave, P wave, and S wave. It predicts that this is strongly attractive, this one is weakly attractive, and this is strongly repulsive. And not only is that exactly what the data says, but when people go and measure the phase shifts, it turns out that the predictions of this Lagrangian for the pi-pi phase shifts at low energy are in very good agreement with the data. And on the figures, I had some figures that demonstrate this. So if you want to learn more about this, it'll be in the notes. In any case, I hope from this lecture you appreciate the interest in this massless limit of QCD. And keep in mind these values of the quark masses, because they're going to come up next week. So this is a good place to stop. Thank you very much. Next week, weak interactions.